Oh, hold up. Smell test. Go ahead. Sniff those pits. Now, your bits. Feet. Toes. Come on. Could be fresher, right? It's all good. Old Spice Total Body Deodorant Spray is gentle enough to use all over your body, giving you 24/7 lasting freshness with daily use, from pits to toes and down below. So every smell test gets a... Shop for Old Spice Total Body Deodorant.
Your spring is about to get a lot more power with the Home Depot. Get gas-like power from mowing, trimming, and blowing with the Ryobi 18-volt OnePlus system starting at just $89. Mowing power that can take on a third of an acre with one charge. Trimming power with up to 2 hours of runtime. And blowing power with 110 miles per hour of clearing force. All on one interchangeable battery. Get cordless gas-like power for the entire lawn with the Ryobi 18-volt OnePlus system. Only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to the Andy Goode Suite, everyone. I'm here and I'm joined by a man that I now call a friend. It's not often you make friends with referees, but I'm delighted to be joined by, some people don't know this, but an ex-international rugby player alongside a current international referee, my good friend, Andrew Brace, a.k.a. Bracey. How are you, mate? Are you well?
How are you getting on, Goody? Yeah, good to be on. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm very good. Great to have you on. You're looking sharp. You must be going out for a date night tonight, are you? Or?
Well, I haven't been back for the last couple of weeks since we got engaged, so she's putting the pressure on me to actually have a night out. Yeah. So.
Lovely, lovely. We'll come on to that later. Firstly, congratulations, but I will get on to that later on.
Okay,
let's go back. Let's rewind, because I mentioned that you played international rugby. Not many people know about it. I certainly know about it because we had a night out in Marseille after the European finals, didn't we? And that's all you talked about, you being a tier one international rugby player as well as an international referee. Let's talk about your rugby career to start off with. You used to be a bit of a nine, a bit of a player back in the day. How was that for you?
I was a terrible player, as most referees will tell you. They gone over to the dark side. But yeah, no, look, I never thought I'd actually go into refereeing. I would have laughed at anybody who said I'd be going down the refereeing route when I moved to Ireland 10 years ago. But yeah, it's just strange how one door shuts, another door opens. I landed on my feet coming over to Ireland, working with Munster Rugby, gave me the opportunity to work as a coach development officer. And then it was Johnny Lacey who was my fellow colleague in the office. I think he was sick of me giving out about referees every Monday morning. So he said, put the whistle where your mouth is. And yeah, the rest is history, I guess. But no, look, I just kind of lost the motivation to play, Goody. It was obviously a big decision when I was only 24 at the time, but I kept getting setbacks. You know, I broke my elbow, leg, ankle. I mean, it was just those setbacks.
And your background, I've done a bit of research, and one of your nicknames is United Nations. Born and bred in different places to where you live now. You obviously spent a bit of time in England as well. Yeah. Just give us a quick synopsis on your early life.
Originally, obviously brought up in Cardiff and then moved to England when I was 18 to do my sports science coaching degree in Plymouth, in Marjohns. So I had a great 3 years in Plymouth there, and then moved over to Ireland. But my half of my family, my father's side, are Belgian, so that's where I managed to somehow bluff my way into the Belgian national team. And
international rugby, mate, that's all that counts.
Exactly, that's how you get in there. So yeah, look, I managed to get my wonderful 5 caps for Belgium. Played over in Dubai in the Emirates All Nations Cup, and then played against the UAE, Hong Kong, Zimbabwe,
the big teams.
we won that competition, and then playing the European, it's like the second tier down from Six Nations. So
yeah,
you know, you had the likes of Georgia, Romania, Portugal, Spain. Tough competition that, and it was that year when I was kind of like only a couple of years with Belgium, and then moved over to the referee, and that kind of kicked off very quickly, and then had to make a decision what way to go, I guess. Because I was playing at the national panel in the All Ireland League here, the Old Crescent. Yeah, I obviously couldn't referee at the same level as playing. So they put me on this IPASS system, which was an interprovincial assessment system. So it's kind of like where you go through the different provinces in Ireland and you do a couple of games there, assessed in each of those provinces, and then move on to the national panel then if you're good enough. And then I remember getting my first game, and it was Leeds against Gala, I think, in the British and Irish Cup. And I'd only been reffing about 4 months, and I was chasing shadows for the full 80 minutes. I can tell you, I didn't know what was going on. And yeah, you learn a lot from those games, don't you? Yeah, it was great. Moved on into the professional league, then the Pro 12 at the time.
you're a scrum half, but you played in the back three for Belgium as well, didn't you?
I did. I think they pushed me more and more out through the positions from 9-10 when the language barrier was a problem, then moved over to the centre wing and then finally on the bench. So
happens to us all, mate. Someone like myself, who I commentate on games and on the podcast, I'm looking at referees going, oh, what's he missed here? It must be easy. How hard was that transition for you to A, become a referee, but then B, actually get to the level you've got to now and the understanding of it all? Because it's a brutal job and it's pretty tough.
Yeah, for sure. It's not getting any easier, as I think we can all agree on. But yeah, starting out, it was difficult, Goody, because I was, you know, you're trying, because you played the game, you try and think that, well, everybody's going to be your mate. You're playing in All-Ireland League, that most of the players would have known you. I knew a lot of the guys from, you know, my work with Munster Rugby. So, but how wrong I was, you know, and that kind of goes out the window. You're just there to do a job. And it was quite a lonely kind of place to be in at the start, because obviously you're used to, you know, playing, you're in that team environment after the game, you know, you're in the change room with the lads, or, you know, on away day, you're on the bus back and you're having the crack. Whereas a referee, you're getting into your car and you're driving back down from the north, back to Limerick, 4-hour drive, and you're pondering whether the game went well or not. And that was my biggest challenge, I guess, at the start, where not knowing how I did in a game. And you only have a couple of people you can bounce off who actually understand it. Obviously, it was my coach at the time, Dave McHugh, and then your close friends who were also refereeing, like Johnny Lacey was excellent to me, who got me into reffing, and the guys who were in the office who were also refereeing. You had in Munster Rugby, you had Ollie Hodges and Peter Fitzgibbon, and those guys, George Clancy, they were all refereeing at the time. You bounce off points of law or some crazy situations that may have happened in your game that you could just trying to get answers to, and just so you don't repeat the same errors then going into the next game. And that was the key for me, is the more games under your belt, the better. You know, that was where I was going to, if I was going to do this, I wanted to try and go all the way to the top. It wasn't just kind of give it a go. And, you know, so it was as many games as I could. Wednesday, schools game, Saturday, club game, try and get as many games under the belt, mud on the boots, and take those learnings, work-ons, takeaways, and try and fix them in the next match.
Let's talk about the build-up to your first full program then. Obviously, I know you did the big stuff in Ireland, but in terms of URC, and it was probably Pro 14 when you first got a professional game, what was the build-up like for that for you? Because you must have refereed over 100 games building up to that point, and players are probably looking at you going, this is his first game.
Well, it was tough, you know, because it was my first game was Pro 12 at the time, was Cardiff Zebra. So being from Cardiff and ref in Cardiff, that, you know, I was there as a kid when I was younger and watching a lot of the games. So it was like that was tough, you know, just to put that aside, you know, but I didn't want it to be a distraction going into the game. But I remember that first game, I learned a lot, like I did in the first BNI Cup game that I got. So I think there was like 30 penalties in the game. It was just so technical, and it wasn't me. You know, I went out there to try and please my coach and the selectors, and Ed Morrison at the time, who was head of Pro 12. And rather than just actually going out and what I've done, like in the games leading me into getting that first opportunity. And that's the reason why I was there. So don't change anything. And I think that's probably the best piece of advice that I ever received, is just don't change anything that what you've done to date. I think when I went into that game, I tried to be over technical, and then I ended up being inconsistent because of it.
And then obviously, you know, with experience comes time, and then you get onto the international panel. Obviously, I know you're an assistant referee a fair bit as well, but your first international game, the build up to that as well must have been pretty nerve wracking, or was it just, it's another game?
Yeah, well, England Barbarians, you'd remember that game well.
Yeah, yeah.
I did that, I think it was 2017, but it wasn't a capped international. And then I did, so my first international was England Samoa in Twickenham. It was just great. You know, you don't think you're ever going to get to that stage. You know, you want to. And as I said, when I started out, that's my goal, to go all the way to the top. But there's something in the back of your mind always questioning, you know, will it happen? I put a lot of work in to get to that point, and I was just delighted to get that opportunity, and thankfully came through unscathed. And it's very rare now, but you come out of that game, nobody talking about you, and then great. And that's always a positive. So
that's the mantra that referees have, right? If you're not being spoken about by one set of fans or players or coaches or the other, then you've had a good game. There's been no decisions that have sort of decided which way the game or the flow of the game is going to go, right?
Yeah, for sure. Look, you're never going to be perfect, Andy. Like, I think we all know that in this game. It's just so grey, and it's not black and white, and you can find so many different interpretations to decisions now, particularly with new directives and law, global law trials and, you know, different laws between competitions and tournaments. But yeah, it is like you want to get those big decisions right. That's what we all strive to get right. It is something that I feel is working for me in the last year or two is just around, I really strive that philosophy with my team now is we're going to get stuff wrong. It's not about being perfect, but it's about nailing those big decisions when they present themselves. And we've got to be ready to nail those big decisions when they do arrive. So you come off the pitch, you're like, oh, did I get that moment right? Did I get that moment wrong? You know, you look at the England-Argentina game lately, recently, that one that you talked about, whether it was knocked on or not. And, you know, I nearly blew the whistle and thankfully I didn't. If I blew the whistle then and Argentina go the length, and that could be a massive talking point then if, you know, that's a high impact decision to me, then incorrectly blow up, because I think I did it earlier in the game where I blew up incorrectly and it wasn't a knock on. So I learned probably the hard way then.
Not really, mate, because Argentina beat us. And if you'd have blown up wrongly, they wouldn't have scored the try. Yeah.
You still think it's a knock on anyway.
No, I don't. I don't think. From all the replays, it's the right thing to do. That's a really hard thing, isn't it? You've got idiots like myself. You've got England fans who you think it's a knock on, and then a lot of referees would blow up there. How hard is it to stay as level-headed as you can when you know you're going to get pelters from some fans? Because in a stadium under that spotlight, England fans would have thought that was a knock-on and why didn't he blow it up? And even if they've seen it on the big screen, or they're too pissed to see it properly on the big screen,
yeah.
Does it affect you in a game, that the noises and the feedback that comes back?
Yeah, you just try and be as level-headed as possible in that moment, don't you? You know, once it's happened, you don't want to be thinking or guessing, because then that's always going to come back and bite you in the ass. So I can't remember what referee it was who said it to me. You don't want to be thinking, you want to be knowing. So, you know, in that moment, let it play out. The problem is there, Andy, like luckily it leads to a try and I can check it within protocol. If he gets tackled short of the line and then we end up going through four or five phases plus, then I can't check it if it leads to a try. And then, you know, you're sitting on your hands then, so uncomfortable because you know potentially you might have got that decision wrong. So that's where it really sits uncomfortably for us sometimes. I had it recently, Bath, Harlequins, and it happens a lot in those tackle situations where does it come off the hand or not? I had it again, Munster, Ulster, come off the hand or not? And then they go 40 meters up the field because it's a turnover. And you need to be in that, like, straight away in the moment, knock on there anybody to put it out there to the team for them to quickly come back. Yes, so they might have a different view. And straight away, yeah, give me the knock on. But I think that comes down to, you know, working hard yourself to put yourself in the best position to make the best decision. Otherwise, you'll end up missing that. So,
and that big thing about team, it is a team thing. I know all eyes are on you as the referee and the supposed sole arbiter of what's gone on in the game. But it is a 4-5 person team, isn't it? With the third referee, or what do they call the one that's just gets his tracksuit off if you pull a calf? Fourth official. There he is, yeah. And with that, you mentioned protocol as well, and there was the big thing about Owen Farrell the other week with Carl Dixon and, you know, the protocol of that. World Rugby have actually come away and said they want to speed the game up, which is great. Mm-hmm. But I'm a big believer in you've got the technology, you've got the TMOs, you've got a team of officials. Sometimes you need to take the time to make the right decision. How does that sit with you? Like, on a knock-on, are you allowed to go to the TMO? Just check that for me. Or is it a relationship that you're allowed to have where a TMO can come in and go, that was actually a knock on and you should blow up?
See, that's the problem, isn't it? You know, we want those decisions to be corrected because you don't want to be the talking point around that. But then at the same time, we need to protect the protocol as well for the integrity of the game. We can't be going up to the TMO to check absolutely everything and anything. I remember my England-France game at the end of the game, the second one. The one that actually went well this time.
We'll come on to that.
The end of the match, there was a Ben Earls holding penalty I gave.
Elbows on the floor, yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, and it was elbows on the floor, the clear off feet penalty, and I reversed the decision.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't have done that because I looked at the screen and I remember it being right in front of the French dugout and they were all going apoplectic and I'm looking at the screen and I clearly got that wrong and I reversed it and I took a rap on the knuckles for it because it's clearly outside protocol. So if he's going to change every single decision or breakdown, well, where do we draw the line? And that's the key. You know, you've got the little knock-ons where we've kind of revised the protocol is around this window of opportunity. So if there's a knock-on that I've given and I set up a scrum and it's clearly been knocked on by the other team first, then a TMO can come in within that window of opportunity and say, no, Andy, there was a knock-on first against England there, not France first. So you don't want it happening quite often, but you see it happening more regularly now, where a TMO can quickly come in and correct that scrum restart or line-out restart. Or, you know, I can't say live play to my TMO, Joy, was that a knock-on? Because that's outside protocol. She can't come in to correct a knock-on live. You can only do that when it leads to a try.
I understand that. My question on that is, going back to your decision, England against France with the Ben Irwin, when you did reverse the penalty, and I put it out there, I think it was brilliant what you did, because you've seen the big screen, you get a rap on the knuckles for going outside protocol. So is the protocol wrong, effectively? Or is there tweaks that we need to make to it?
Yeah, I guess I think the tweaks we've made now has been great. You know, you have that window of opportunity, as I said, to correct certain things. But I think we've just got to be better to get that live on field and just accept that there will be, you know, breakdown decisions are so,
yeah,
they're so gray and complex that you can end up giving a decision one way or the other a lot of the time. So if we start going down that road, Andy, then we're probably going down a road of no return, because then the TMO will be reffing everything. So I think the point on that one was, it was at the end of the game, and it was a massive decision for me, because, you know, obviously everything that happened in the England-France game before that, and we're not coming out at the right end. And then, you know, your feeling now is like, close this game out. And then if England kick to the corner, we're back to square one again, and they score off that, and England win the game, and I'm the talking point again. So I did that deliberately, because I didn't want to be the talking boy. I want to get a big decision right. But a big decision at the end of the game in the 78th minute, it's still the same at the second minute of the game. But I guess you can't be doing that for 80 minutes, because you're throwing the protocol out the window then, I guess. You know, I don't want to be stopping the game every single moment I get a decision wrong. Or, you know, you put a chip in a ball to show that every time there's a forward pass, do we want another 50 scrums in the game then? Because that's what's going to happen.
Mate, when I played, the more stop-start it was, the better, because I could breathe for a bit. But we mentioned it a few times, that France game, England-France game. It's not funny, and it is funny, because you can mention it and you can look back on it now. First and foremost, obviously, let's just talk through the scenario of what happened and how it happened, and then we'll get onto what happened afterwards, which was the bad part about it all, obviously, and the thing that gets the most airtime, and rightly so, for how bad things can get.
Well, first and foremost, like, I came off the game and I thought we did swimmingly well. You know, you don't, and this is what happens in a lot of games now. You come off and there's certain things you don't know about. So in this moment there, I think it was what, 76 minutes in, and there's a little knock on at the base of the rock from Billy Vunipola, and then it goes through one more phase, and then I end up awarding a penalty, and then Farrell kicks the corner, and then England score off that, and we end up going to extra time, and I bring the whole house of cards down on top of myself, because you know, I didn't perform well that day, and
we won. I'm all right with it, mate. We won.
But I can look back at it now, and it's been very cathartic as well for me. And, you know, I can move on from this now. You know, the second England-France game that I did, and in that second Six Nations game, it was great to get that opportunity again, only 2 months on from that Autumn Nations Cup final. But yeah, look, we missed the knock-on of the base of the rock, and we don't get it on field. And it goes back to the protocol then again, Andy. Like, you know, that big moment, big decision, you want to get that, but... Like Ben Whitehouse was in the truck at the time, and he took a lot of criticism, and wrongly so, because you can't come in for it. So it's not his fault. You know, I should have got it on field. And it probably kickstarted a lot of what we talked about recently, just around the protocol then as well, of, you know, if that's a World Cup final, you don't want to be remembered for that. And yeah, it led into extra time, and there was a lot of decisions that heavily went against France wrongly. And I wasn't consistent. You know, what I did in the first kind of 60 minutes of that game wasn't consistent with what I did in the back end of the game. So,
yeah, definitely. Now, the knock-on effect of the error that was made, and, you know, I still believe that Ben Whitehouse should have come in and said, it's a knock-on, mate, whether it's outside of protocol or not, at such a key moment. But the knock-on effect of what happened, you know, the social media abuse that comes out, and my big thing around social media abuse is, The social media companies need to sort of regulate it so that people are accountable. How hard is that for you as a referee, and how hard was that for you? You're getting pelters from France and some horrible things said to you and the family. Incredibly tough. Is it something that you thought, actually, is this fucking job worth it or not?
Yeah, look, it was, I'm not going to lie, it was a tough year. You know, I lost my dad and after the elation of my, of getting the Six Nations, my dad had organized for the whole family to come over. And then 3 weeks later, he passes. And then you're in two minds of, oh, what do I do here? The whole world's turned upside down. Do you ref the game? What would he want? And when I eventually kind of came to terms with it, well, you don't come to terms with it, I guess, but 3 weeks on, it's still raw. And my family wanted me to do the game. That's what he would have wanted you to have done. And I did the game. And my dad was my best friend. And they're like, you know, he was like, you know, I lent on him a lot around my communication style. Like when I started out reffing, I was probably trying to be somebody that I wasn't. You know, I wasn't natural, as I said. My communication, I was quite aggressive. You know, now I'm just, I try to speak to players in the way that I would like to be spoken to myself. You know, just and that communication, my dad was teacher, ex-teacher, chief executive of the Teaching Council for Wales. So he was big around that communication style. And he said to me, he was like, you're not yourself when, you know, in certain scenarios. And I bite back to players and then you just have confrontation. And kind of getting back onto the whole kind of aftermath of what happened in the England-France game, I guess that, as I said, dad was so close to me and I put various posts out, you know, it was his, is obituary at the time and what he had achieved. He did a lot of work with UNESCO. And so I put this post out and I you know me, Andy, like you follow me, I don't really post stuff. But I put this obituary out on my father and that was the kind of recent post after the England-France game that I'd posted. And they jumped on the back of that and it was hard, you know, like comments you get and, you know, we can all take criticism as referees. We're in the wrong job if we can't, but it's when it crosses that line then and they, you know, they find your family and your sister and your mother and my partner at the time and send them direct death threats and saying we'll find you and hope you'll die. And it's tough, you know, because you take that personally then. And look, I'm not, as you've seen recently, I'm not the only person to have, I can categorically tell you that every referee would have experienced certain abuse across the way, along the way. I think, you know, it is getting worse. You know, there's no regulation on social media, as you said. So whatever you post now, you without any repercussions, and people get so emotional after around the game. And I think like, everybody's entitled to an opinion, but when it crosses that line, they just got to be very careful of what we want our game to become, because it could be ended up going down a road of no return otherwise.
Yeah, it's awful. And there's a very big difference between critiquing something and then just going on and being abusive for the sake of it. But at any point when that was kicking off, and it's incredibly sad to hear, about the passing of your father again, because I know you were very close, but also the knock-on effect it has to your family, your sister, and the abuse that they took for no reason except for some French idiots find them and they're related to you. And it's awful to hear. Did it make you ever think this is not worth the hassle?
Yeah, for sure. You do question it. You know, it was a tough few months after that. You know, you do question everything. Is it worth it? I had great support networks around me. You know, the IRFU were great. And, you know, my closest friends here and referees and, you know, reaching out. I remember, you know, even players as well, Andy, like, you know, like a lot of the Irish Munster players reaching out to me and, you know, Hugo Monier picking up the phone. I didn't know Hugo at the time. And, like, just it was just nice to see that the rugby family kind of came together after that, you know. And I was just one example, as I said, you know, it's happened on so many occasions. But it has been very cathartic for me, because when I got the opportunity to do that England-France game the second time, it was like great to have that release and that to have gone well, you know, and nobody talking about me this time, to kind of put it behind you then. What kind of sparked a lot of the media was a lot of talk that I'd been dropped going into the European game the following week. So I was doing Toulouse, Exeter.
Exeter, yeah. You were moved, not dropped.
Exactly. So that's
like... If I remember right, you did a Humdinger. Did you do Bristol Claremont?
That was it. Like he said, it was Joao Jouche at the time, you know, he said, I think it's safer to kind of move you into this game. And I agreed. So we went in to do Bristol Clermont. It was just a really nice game. Two attacking DNA teams and it was great. But I remember during the game, I'm not going to lie, I was got a little bit dizzy. You know, I was like, just I was mentally exhausted. But yeah, it just showed the anxiety. And, you know, you're just like, well, what happens if this goes back badly again? You know, if there's a decision against the French team, then I'm the talking point again. It was tough to go straight back into that European cup competition, because predominantly you do, as Irish officials, we do the English French games for neutrality purposes. So
yeah,
I was just praying that everything went well, and you know, you're not the talking point coming out of that game, and thankfully it went well. So
yeah, it did. I remember sunny day, it was tries galore, so you weren't talked about, mate. That's a good thing, right?
Your spring is about to get a lot more power with the Home Depot. Get gas-like power from mowing, trimming, and blowing with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system starting at just $89. Mowing power that can take on a third of an acre with one charge. Trimming power with up to 2 hours of runtime. And blowing power with 110 miles per hour of clearing force. All in one interchangeable battery. Get cordless gas-like power for the entire lawn with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system. Only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Let's talk about the life of a referee then, because it is, you know, I've got to know a few of the referees, you know, I've spoken at length to you off sort of air, and it's a tough job, right?
It is tough, you know. Now with the URC, where every weekend is an away game, because obviously with the South African teams now involved, and you know, the end of last season I was down in South Africa 3 times in 2 months, so I did a double header straight after Europe, came back, went back down for the quarterfinal 2 weeks later, came back, and then went back down for the final a week later. And then you're off to Dubai then for the camp fitness testing. I say fitness testing.
Your favorite bit, right? Or everyone's favorite bit.
Yeah, the dreaded fitness test. 4 days there in camp in Dubai, and then straight on to Australia. So I did the free test on there in Australia, England, and then you're home, not knowing whether you're going to go again then in a few weeks for rugby championship. Yeah, those appointments came out, and then, yeah, that was my off season. Then I knew that month was off season. Then I went back down to Australia then a month later for the Bledisloe. So yeah, it's tough. Last year I was 180 days away from home. It's a lot. It's half the year, isn't it? It's out of a hotel. It's just difficult, and people see it as the glamour life. You know, they don't see the other side to it. You know, and it is a great life. Traveling the world, you know, you're visiting some great countries, reffing the best teams in the world. But yeah, the week is like when we're back here, then in a domestic week, like leading into Europe this week or the last couple of months since the season's began, our routine, or I like to be in routine as much as possible, but our routine would be like Monday would be a recovery session. You're doing your reviews. So that would be kind of your day to get your review, your match review done, and put it up onto an AMS platform, which is our online system, which is where we get reviewed with our performance reviewer and selector. And then you wait back then to hear from your selector and your performance reviewer to have a call with them to go through the big ticket items in the game, the playlist, and you do every area of the game then, Andy, you know, so it's like speed, safety, space, line out more, scrum, and then your overall summary. So you do a self-review on each of those areas of the game.
Is that your speed or speed of the game?
Well, my speed would be quite slow. So.
No, I'm asking that for a reason. You must have seen the clip, right?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I'm getting some seconds for that now as well, by the way.
Although it's great, the clip for our listeners that's gone out on social media, I'm trying to remember who was it. Was it an intercept, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or a breakaway. Who were you chasing?
England, South Africa. It was Arundel, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. So the speed of you at the touchline, you didn't even look like you'd broken sweat, but you were keeping up with them.
I'm trying to get my call up for Belgium again, you know?
There you go. The speed's good. But yeah, I mean, sorry, carry on to your week. I just had to bring that up because I thought it was great. Proper wheels.
Yeah, no, I did get some slagging over that. Yeah, so yeah, do the whole review of that, and then you have a coaching call then with the reviewer, and then go through the game and how they felt you went, and you'd have your audit on your accuracy report then as well, Andy. So it's like a traffic light system where green is good penalty, accurate penalty, red is error, and then amber is like kind of a coaching query. So that's kind of how the review system would look. And then Tuesday, then we have as our main kind of training day, we'd be here, we'd be double session, which pitch, speed, endurance, conditioning, and then you're into the gym, and then do our training in the morning and go through the weekend's kind of clips or the talking points from the game. Yeah, Wednesday would be a day off for me. And then Thursday, double session again. You could be traveling out then in the evening if you're Friday game, Saturday back, Sunday recovery, or, you know, Friday travel, Saturday game, Sunday recovery. So I guess the modern referee has changed now, isn't it? The profile of a modern referee is completely different to where it was 20 years ago when you were playing.
Exactly. Well, no, you're right. I retired 6 years ago, but yeah, I hear you.
Okay. Tried to stretch it out. But yeah, no, there's more responsibilities now. And I talked a lot when we went full-time 5 years ago around the difference between a professional referee and a high-performance environment. So I didn't want to be just a professional referee title. I wanted it to be a professional referee in a high-performance environment. It's and having all those resources in place, so your S&C structures, your nutritional support, your psych support now, your high-performance coaching, your mental skills, everything comes into it.
You mentioned their nutrition. Do TMO, I want to become a TMO. Do TMOs get nutritional packages as well, or is it just choice of biscuits in the van?
Only for you, mate.
I've got to ask you first and foremost about the whole Razzie Erasmus video, which personally I found educating in terms of what he saw and what they see as a coaching team. And yeah, other people said it went too far, and obviously the abuse afterwards to the referee was just beyond belief from social media again. But what was your take on Razzie's video, and how did you find it from a referee's perspective? I don't suppose you'd have learned anything yourself because you know all the laws, but did you find it entertaining, interesting, bang out of order? Which one was it?
I just think when you're in a position of power, you hold a very strong voice. Only people listen to you, but they follow you, and one would argue that it's the butterfly effect of what that then leads to, I guess. People see that as acceptable, and is it okay for me to then do it? Can I then critique another performance, or does that lead then to other coaches or other players, other referees to do the same? And then we go down a road of no return. So we're not saying, like, as referees, not saying protect me if I've had a bad performance. It's not about that. We have clear channels. The coaches, all coaches would feed in their feedback after a game, pre-game and post-game. And you'd answer to those clips and give your views on those clips. There has to be accountability to performance, and there is. I can tell you there is, whether that myth is out there, there's not. But yeah, I just think we've seen time and time again, obviously, on the social media platforms, that what this can lead to can potentially be very harmful for the game.
So Razzie, stay off the videos is what you're saying. The other one I want to talk to you about, and we had a bit of back and forth about this privately, is the scenario that you're involved in the summer down in Australia with the Bledisloe Cup, my good friend now Matthew Reynal as well, and what happened with Bernard Foley and how that transpired. Talk through that, because you were on the touch as assistant referee for that game. It must have been some intense atmosphere at the end, and getting in and out of the stadium was, I laugh about it, I shouldn't laugh. It's probably brutal, was it, for Matthew Reynal and with how it all transpired? Because, Addy, listen, they'd have won the Bledisloe.
No, it is. Goody, it was really tough because I know how he was feeling, after the game, the aftermath of England, France, and I'd been in that position myself, and I'd like to think that I was able to offer my support to him during that week. And obviously we were there as a team, Pierre Brise and Ben Whitehouse as well, so the four of us were able then to move on to Eden Park the following week that I was doing. And the big thing for me, I just said, let's just go away and for a few days, don't look at social media, don't look at the media, because if you want to go looking for it, you'll find stuff. And I think it was important for us just to kind of leave rugby aside for a couple of days and just let everything digest, I guess, because obviously the media world were kicking off again. And it was important for us just to kind of get some clear headspace. Matthew was in a tough position there, and go away, play a bit of golf for a couple of days. Yeah, enjoy each other's company, because we just put so much pressure on ourselves leading into that game.
So did you take a bit of money off Matthew Reynal on the golf course as well and really kick him while he was down? Or?
Well, it wouldn't be hard. It wouldn't be hard with that, would it? Couldn't hit snow off a rope.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. But that decision, I went on social media and said it myself, he got it right. Like, he'd given him enough warning to say, mate, kick it out, stop wasting time, kind of thing. And we even had Nick White on our podcast, and I said, when Nick White actually put the ball out against Scotland, I said, mate, you listen to a referee for the first time in your life as an Australian. And I can throw away those comments, you can't as a ref. But personally, I thought you got the decision right, but obviously the whole of Australia didn't.
Yeah, it's a tough one, because as you said, Matthew's asked him several occasions to play, put time off, and then went again, and obviously didn't listen, and then that followed through then to the scrum. But I guess we talk a lot about the technical decisions versus is it the best decision for the game? And I guess that's something that we reviewed after the game, is just around what's the best decision for the game.
What are the referees like together? And you mentioned then you travelled a bit. You're obviously as a team with a few various different people around different competitions. You get to spend a lot of time, sometimes probably more time than you want, with other people as part of your team. What do you get up to in terms of an international week compared to, say, a URC week or a Heineken Champions Cup weekend?
Yes, I think it's important that you make the most, well, I try to make the most of the week or the 2 weeks you're away. You don't want to just be stuck in a hotel room and doing nothing for 2 weeks. And, you know, you could easily just get a laptop out and look at several clips or games and preparing for a match. I think you've got to enjoy the time. You know, you never know when it's going to all be over. So I think you've got to enjoy these great places, incredible countries you get the privilege to go and visit. Like the Bledisloe now just gone, you know, there's a lot of keen golfers in the group now, some bad ones, including myself. So get out on the golf course as much as possible. And yeah, and then obviously you try and keep on top of training as well. And then you don't want to be doing the dog on it for 2 weeks and then you end up going match day and chasing shadows for the 80. So it's that work-life balance, isn't it, I guess.
And for that, you do obviously, you know, every game you referee, you're obviously doing a bit of prep yourself for looking at the teams you're going to referee. You don't want to go in with any preconceived ideas, but how much time do you spend sort of looking at the games previously that they've played in and looking for traits in how teams attack, defend, scrummage, driving line out, etc.?
For me, it's a big part around where you're going to be challenged in the game. So I don't need to tell, you know, like Mathieu Reynal and Pierre Brizet in that game what a jumping across or a line out is or what a side entry in a mall is. I need to know where we're going to be challenged in the game. Remember, like Steve Hansen talked to us as a guest speaker in Dubai, and there was one thing that really stood out for me is just the difference between that preconceived idea versus trends. Trends are factual. You know, you go in with a preconceived idea, it might not have happened, but if it's factual over the course of, say, a series of games, well, then that is something that you might be challenged in. Or, you know, is it a tight head who's prone to collapsing, overextending, versus a loose head who's prone to hinging? Or, you know, it's not going in with the preconceived ideas, but where are you going to be challenged as a team? I think that's the level of detail a modern referee, as I talked about earlier on, has got to now. You know, that detail, all right, we're going to be challenged here in the red zone, close to the line, maul, team maul, like this team maul every time. So we need to be tuned in, we need to stay connected, and the role clarity then as well, Andy. Like, you know, so the front AR is looking at his side, I'm looking at my side of the back, just so you can be as consistent as possible and accurate as possible. It's, you know, it's one area you look at that we spend a lot of time in now, because it's the hardest area to referee.
Yeah,
there's so much going on, and that's really important, that whole role clarity.
And do you have many WhatsApp groups where you're all talking about decisions, or is there much cross-pollination around Premiership referees chatting to you boys? And I know that you're quite friendly with a few of them. Is that regular contact, or is it more so when you're in a camp or when you're sort of working together?
Yeah, we're all very close. It's a really tight group, Goody. It's probably the tightest it's ever been before. Just we all get on well, and there's good honesty within the group. You know, people and referees are not afraid now to speak up, and whether it's in groups or in camps and meetings or in Zoom calls, without the fear of being shut down. So everybody, I think, there now is in a position where we can give their own view, which might not have been the same before, which is great. It's a great position to be in. A lot of the referees are from different competitions I'm close with in the Premiership, Luke and Matt and Super Rugby there with Ben O'Keefe and Brendan, Paul Williams. There's so many of the guys that we're all regularly in contact with each other now, because you're meeting regularly, you're working with each other more regularly. That's really, really key now leading into a Rugby World Cup, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And we'll come on to the Rugby World Cup in a second. From the group of referees and people that all work closely together, you must have some different characters. Who's the biggest joker that likes to make the funnies?
Matt Carley can be well out there. He's very dry humour. He's well able to bury you. Ben O'Keefe's good crack. There's a lot of guys, you know, different personalities, but good group.
I think that personality trait's changed as well, hasn't it, from what people's perception of referees used to be to, like, you're seeing these younger referees now, like yourself, like Luke Pearce and Matt Carley, these guys that you say, you know, they're not school teachers that rule with an iron fist, are they? They're actual human beings that are characters, and, you know, you can potentially sometimes have a bit of banter with them, which never used to be the case.
Yeah, and we're all very similar age group now as well. which is good. I think that transition, we lost a lot of experience, didn't we, in the last World Cup. A lot of referees retired, Nigel, Jerome, Romain, Pascal, Johnny, George. There's a lot of referees, senior referees who retired there. There's that transition group. A lot of us have worked together, come through Junior World Cups together, worked together in European competitions. And you look at the Junior World Cups, I was there with Paul Williams, Craig Evans. So, the guys who have kind of come along the journey with you, which is nice. So all the guys have similar stories as well. So
you talk about the production line and a lot of younger referees now. Is there a production line, and how do you recruit referees ultimately to get to your level? Is it a hard thing to do because it's under so much scrutiny?
Yeah, it is. It is. I think it is going to be harder to recruit, but I think there's so much good being done as well. I'm obviously talking with the IRFU now, and we've got our four development managers within the province. Who are looking at the referees within the local associations and societies, and that's the system. Then they come through into the interprovincial assessment system, into the national panel, and then Johnny's job is other part of high performance coaches is talent identification. So, that might be looking going into local provinces within the academy. So guys who might not be offered a full-time contract or a development contract, that this might be another avenue for them. And I think there's similar systems in the other countries as well. How Carl kind of was identified, in the Premiership, he's still playing in the Premiership, but then he was able to referee in the Championship. So if he was, coming to the end of his contract playing Saturday, then he can ref in the Championship on a Sunday. It was a really nice kind of stepping stone. Our stepping stone is the All-Ireland League. You had the British and Irish Cup at the time, and now it's like the A interprovincial games, again, good quality games. And the standard is much, much higher now, the quality and competitive games that referees can, again, that experience too is massive. So that will be the system, and very similar in other countries as well.
Yeah, good stuff. Now, there's been a bit of progress with the Referees Association as well, hasn't there? In terms of looking after you boys and being a voice and maybe being involved in some of the law changes as well and influence on that. Very important for you boys to have a voice and girls to have a voice in terms of world rugby and where you go and your jobs. And we're seeing strikes in the UK galore. Please don't go on strikes. We don't have a game. But you know what I mean? That you need that voice for you guys and girls.
Yeah. It's great to finally announce this, Goody. It's a much needed support pillar for us. For the first time, we now have that collective voice and support mechanism for us as international referees and television match officials across the game. So the establishment of IRMO, it will act as that, that key representative body for us within World Rugby decision-making structures. So, and that's across a wide range of areas, from law review, as you said, to individual performances, to physical, mental well-being, whilst upholding the core values that are central to the game's growth, which is hugely important if we're going to promote, develop and inspire the not only the current, but more importantly, the next generation of match officials.
And definitely pay as well. Get the boys more pay. Boys and girls need more pay as referees. I can say that. You can't.
That's where I need you as my agent.
Let's chat about some of the things you've seen on the field. The best things you've seen on the field from a refereeing perspective. Are you always sort of conscious that you can give players some banter? I know we've seen the Nigel Owens go down his route, Wayne Barnes a little bit. I had some interactions with Wayne Barnes that went pretty viral on social media, basically because I was too fucked to play the game and he's laughing at me. But best things you've seen on the field, you obviously enjoy it as well, right?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. Probably the most embarrassing moment at the start of my career was my first Highland Cup game, Wasps, your club, against Ebra, where you can actually see it on YouTube, a referee's worst nightmare, where I actually ended up getting pushed over by James Haskell. But I didn't realise that when I went to break my fall, the whistle had gone into the mud.
Oh, no.
So I only needed a couple of minutes later when obviously I need the whistle and I go to blow for a penalty, blowing the pee out of it and nothing coming out and the players are running on 40 metres upfield.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to chase the players down. But the one that really stands out, and it was another game that didn't go swimmingly well and I learned a lot from, was thrown in the deep end in the semi-final in La Rochelle Gloucester a number of years back. And probably thrown in too early, probably wasn't ready. Semi-final, Challenge Cup, it was a big game. And a valuable lesson I learned that day was to, when accusing somebody of simulation, I don't know if you remember, but Richard Hibbard what I thought I saw in the corner of my eye, that he'd been punched in the stones, and he just dived on the floor. So then in the next stoppage, I said, I probably came out with the old Nigel Owens line, classic line of, don't appreciate you throwing yourself on the floor like that. It's the wrong game.
Yeah.
To his response going, mate, I've just been punching the stones. I was like, no, wrong game for that. Shut him down. And then I came off the pitch to see the BT Sport to put this out there. Thought another game that had gone swimmingly well, to know that I was trending on Twitter. Richard Hibbard's wife is going ballistic at me. Because, yeah, I've accused him of simulation. He's actually been punched full-blown in the stones.
Well, it's against the French. What do you expect?
So, good lesson learned there. Yeah, be careful what you say.
Any funny stories from captains, pre-match sort of speeches, coin tosses? You must have some characters come in.
Well, one of my first games in the coin toss, and when I moved to Ireland, I didn't know what the heads or tails was on the coin. But that was an embarrassing moment, you know, when I went to flick the coin and they called heads and they're looking at me going, and I'm like,
showing them the coin. You choose.
I'm showing the coin. It's like, yeah, just kept nodding and they're looking at me going, yeah, so what's the decision here? So should have taken the English coin, mate.
Yeah, definitely. You know that one. You mentioned it before about simulation and kidology and all that stuff around players. I'm seeing a bit of that creeping in to the game, because ultimately it can't be self-policed anymore, can it, around players punching and sorting things out themselves. That's gone from the game a long time ago. But are you seeing that creeping in a bit more, that the back chat, that everyone is trying to referee the game? I know, you know, you've said a few things when you've refereed, and I think you said something to Owen Farrell the other week because he was a bit chopsy. Is that right?
I look back at that game now, and it was a Saracens too long game, and I probably went back to my old self, and I actually apologised to Owen just the way I spoke to him. But respect works both ways, you know. If we demand respect as referees, we have to show it as well. I think that's really, really important, you know. And I go back to what I said around my father, you know, and the communication side of things. But I remember doing my first return game after COVID. It was Munster Leinster. It was the first time I ref in Munster against Leinster, and I speak a lot to Paul O'Connell just around the shape of the game and, you know, what to expect in a match and that. And on the day, you had obviously two of the best players in the world, and Peter Manny and Johnny Sexton, who are the two players who know well how to push you in the right way. So I was like, getting ready for that game. How are you gonna speak to them? You know, not come across like I was in the past, where quite overly aggressive and have that soft hands approach. And I remember one thing that stuck with me, you know, is like, somebody like Johnny Sexton or Peter Manny, as example, you know, international players have to have their say. And I was very quick to shut down, you know, that whole, you know, listen to understand versus listen to reply. We're very quick to reply to people, you know, you're not actually understood what he said. And I think a lot of the time you have a valid point. You know, if Johnny Sexton's coming to you, a lot of the time he's right. And it's important to listen.
In his eyes.
And you look back at it afterwards and you're like, yeah, he was right there. You know, I think if you shut down that conversation, all you have then is confrontation. And that's only going to end in a negative way for you as a referee, I think.
But sometimes it has to be that way as well, though, doesn't it? Once it gets too much.
It does. And I think that's where there's the fine line, right? I didn't see it that way, you know, but it's not a conversation now and you move on. But you're still allowed to have that say, but in the right way, in the right manner.
Last couple of things then. We've got the Six Nations coming up. You've got Wales, Scotland, right?
I've got Scotland, Wales, yeah. Up in Murrayfield.
Scotland, Wales. So what are you going to do up in Edinburgh? Because, you know, you're going to spend a bit of time up there. You got any plans? Jim Hamilton's up there. Go out for a beer with him.
Does he like me? I'm not sure if he does.
He does, mate. He's jealous of our relationship. That's what I think. Because
he is very jealous. Yeah, I get in about lunchtime the day before. So it'd be, you don't really get too much time, Andy, to be honest, you know, because you're getting there, you might have a coaches meeting with the two teams, and then you're out for dinner the night before the game, and then early night, and then you're ready for the game. So
yeah,
in there, do the job, and then you're out.
Stay the night, stay at gyms. He'll show you a good time up in Edinburgh. World Cup round the corner, obviously, later this year. You mentioned it earlier around, you went to the 2019 World Cup, but as an assistant referee, you're obviously right in the mix for selection for the 2023 World Cup. There's a number of you that are in the mix as well. How's that process work for our fans and listeners? And what are your hopes, expectations, etc.?
So obviously we have our last window now coming up into Six Nations to perform and show the management team to try and put your hand up for that seat to France. So I think selection is towards the end of the season, so it's like post Six Nations, so it'll be the last window, and then we should know then leading into the July warm-up games then what the panel will be. Yeah, and the World Cup's on then.
You obviously sit under the Irish banner, don't you?
Yeah.
But you're Welsh with a bit of English in there and a bit of Belgian and obviously Irish. It's probably an easy question for you. World Cup final, Andrew Brace refereeing it. That means Ireland can't make it, or Ireland are in the final and Ireland win it. What's your preference?
Any team. I'm United Nations, as you said, so I'm mixed bag, so I cover all bases.
Yeah, so you can't referee Ireland. So basically what you're saying is you want to referee the World Cup final more than Ireland get to the World Cup final.
No, I would love to see Ireland get there, of course.
You're saying that because you live there, not because you're fully Irish. Yeah. We mentioned it earlier in the last couple of things, getting married. When's the wedding?
No date set yet. I'll let her plan that.
Okay, more importantly, fuck the wedding. When's the stag doing? Where is it? That's what everyone exactly. wants to know.
You're coming, mate. You're coming.
And then last thing, obviously, I put it on social media, I think. I put it on our podcast, definitely. I loved it when you were refereeing the other week, and when you're saying use it, it was so pronounced that I had to record it and send it to you, and I got some stick back. Do the referees give themselves a bit of banter around that? Do you get stuck into each other for things you've done on the field?
Well, they do, yeah. Thanks to you now, that's turned into a big big hit. So the lads and,
sorry, mate.
The lads and the family and back home, they don't let me live this down, you know? So it's like this turned into a bit of a drinking game now, you know? You had the Buffalo, now it's turned into a use it call, so you have 5 seconds. So cheers for that, Andy.
I might just play it. I should just play it for our listeners, shouldn't I, really?
And use it!
I love it.
I did have a good laugh off that.
Do they give you some stick to that? Because have you changed it now? Have you gone a bit softer on it, have you?
I'm trying now because that's in my bloody head. So.
Sorry, mate. Bring it back. I want to see Scotland against Wales. I want to hear the big and use it! It'll be quality. It'll be quality. Weird. Mate, appreciate you coming on and your openness and honesty. Obviously, wish you all the best for the Six Nations and more importantly for the selection for the World Cup. It's been a pleasure having you on. Just keep shouting, use it.
Thanks, Goody. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.